Jenny.
Hello, I'm Scott.
Welcome to the fifth episode of the Reading Envy podcast.
Where we'll have what you're reading.
And today's guest, we have someone who prefers to be known as Tamahome.
Tam.
Hello.
Hello.
I really wanted...
SFF Audio?
Yes, it's SFF Audio and it is Sunday morning.
I thought so.
Yeah. Everything feels wrong. Actually, Tamahome is the reason that I ever got into podcasting at all, because there were these forums for the Sword and Laser Book Club back in Ning before they were in Goodreads. And one day he said, hey, you should come be on the SFF Audio podcast. And I did, and I had a great time. And so here I am on my number two podcast.
Wow.
How about that?
It's all because of you.
I am the seed.
You're the seed.
I tell you what, yeah, a lot of very good advice from Tam over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Really?
Really.
That's right. You said you talked about me on your last...
I did, and I said you've improved my life. Yeah.
Wow.
I'm trying to remember why you were brought up in the first place. I can't quite remember. But it was for a good reason, because there's lots of reasons all the time. But yeah.
I'll have to check it out.
Yes, indeed. Please do.
So tell us a little bit about what the kinds of things you like to read, just in general.
It's mostly science fiction, although lately I've been getting on a big comic book kick, almost even more than science fiction. Yeah, I don't read too much in fantasy.
Mm-hmm. When you say comic books, like graphic novels and type, isn't that science fiction as well, or... Do you read stuff that's not genre in graphics?
Well, whatever superhero is, I read a lot of. I read that.
Uh huh.
Yeah, I think it's mostly some kind of genre.
Okay. Yeah, you were the one who said read Saga. You also told me to read Lock and Key, which I absolutely love. And what have I got? I'm leaning back here. I've got three volumes of that. I haven't read the third yet, but loved one and two.
Yeah, I considered talking about Lock and Key.
Cool.
That was one of my possible choices, but I'm going with something else.
All right. Well, cool.
And Saga is nominated for the Hugo, so I think you're going to probably read that.
Sure will. Yeah.
You're going to have a Hugo podcast, right?
Possibly. I think we probably will.
Thinking about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, well, good. We're glad you're here.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. Thanks. For sure.
Thanks. I guess I'll get started first.
Okay.
Just talking about the books we've been reading.
Mm-hmm.
And a few days ago, I finished reading the book Geek Love. It's by Katherine Dunn. And actually, before I tell you what the book's about, the reason I got into this book is because Wired Magazine had a 25th anniversary feature article about it. And honestly, I think I might have seen the cover before, but I assumed that Geek Love was, you know, pocket protectors, computer programmers, that kind of thing. But the second definition of geek is like a carnival sideshow performer, more specifically the women that would bite the heads off of chickens.
That was a thing?
Apparently that was a thing.
I thought that was Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah,
apparently he wasn't so original. But in Geek Love, it's this family, and it's this couple who meets because the woman is a geek. And they're kind of disappointed that the sideshow performances kind of get marginalized. I mean, they are sideshows, but, you know. So when she gets pregnant, they get married. She gets pregnant a whole bunch of times, and they feed her amphetamines and arsenic and other types of chemicals. And so that they have all these kids with all these issues, physical issues, those that live. Half of them don't live, and they carry them around in jars. And so there's Arturo, who's kind of an aqua boy because he has flippers instead of limbs. And then conjoined twins and an albino hunchback, Olympia, who is the main narrator of the book. And then... A son they name Chick, and at first he seems normal, and everyone else thinks he seems normal, but he has kind of a lesser-known gift, I guess. They call them gifts.
Huh. Is this, like, set in present day or past?
It is.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it was written in 1989, so 1989 present, and it's set in Oregon. I mean, they travel around a lot, but by the time the novel starts, Ollie, Olympia, is living in a home, kind of like an apartment building, and her mother has gone kind of senile, and she's living in that same building. And Olympia's daughter is living in that building, but does not know that the albino dwarf is her mother. So I'm not really sure that there's much of a storyline exactly. I mean, it starts in that present day, and then it kind of goes back and traces like the development of the kids and what happens around the circus. Like the flipper boy, Artie, starts a cult where people start getting their limbs surgically removed. And they follow him because they're celebrating all these differences.
Wow.
It's a really disturbing and dark book. I just had no idea what I was getting into. It was picked for one of my book clubs that I do. So, yeah, let me see what else I should say.
No, there was a TV show that somebody told me, hey, you would really like this. And it's called Carnival. And then the other day I was watching, can't even remember what channel, and they had some kind of a reality show with carnival people on it. Ooh. You guys heard of that? I can't even remember what it's called, but I mean, what you just said reminded me, you know, kind of a dark, slightly disturbing kind of a tone.
Yeah. Well, and I think some people are disturbed by circuses to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And the disturbing part isn't really the fact that they're in the circus at all. It's kind of just how everyone thinks so darkly, and they like, there's this one quote about how it's a good thing we don't know what babies think because they're evil creatures.
Oh jeez.
How deep and sticky is the darkness of childhood, how rigid the blades of infant evil. So I, you know, it's the same way I laugh at horror movies too. I can't help it.
Oh my gosh.
So is this fantasy or science fiction?
No, I mean, it's very, it's considered very literary, but it kind of has that crossover nature the way Infinite Jest does, you know, where you have the deformed characters and they're doing things that are really unrealistic, but in this very realistic world.
That is fascinating.
Have I convinced you want to read it?
No, that's a book that probably won't go on the list. But it's bizarre.
It is.
Yeah. I would read the Kindle sample. see from there.
Yeah.
It's kind of one of those, it's like a train wreck novel, you know? Just can't stop reading it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it kept your attention. Different.
It did. It did. And it wasn't just kind of the silly little details about the people. I mean, they actually did things and that helped.
Mm.
I wasn't expecting the cult part, that's for sure.
The cult. Yeah, and that's a cult I wouldn't join either.
No. I kind of like my toes.
Holy smokes. That's wild.
And my arms. So that's probably all cool. I have to say about it.
All right. Well, okay. Mine's going to be a lot different than that one. The first one I want to talk about, first of all, are either of you dog people?
I'm both dog and cat.
Excellent. Yeah.
And, I think so.
And Jenny's got a dog, I think.
Yeah.
Well, Julie, my cohort on the Good Story podcast, A Good Story is Hard to Find, she recommended a book for me called Suspect by Robert Crais, C-R-A-I-S, who's a crime writer. And this is a crime novel. But what's cool about this book, or the reason that she recommended it to me, was because one of the characters in the book named Maggie is a German Shepherd. And I've got one of those. That's the dog that's right here at my feet at the moment. but I thought it was excellent. Well, I take that back. Part of it was excellent. Part of it, not so excellent. there's parts in this book where the dog plays a large part. And those were by far the most interesting. In fact, it was an audiobook that I listened to, and whenever it got away from that, I was wishing it would get back to it. So I would listen for those parts. I'd be riveted during those parts, and not, I can't even hardly recall the names of anybody that was in the mystery itself. But the book starts off with a German Shepherd who's a bomb-sniffing dog in Iraq or Afghanistan. I don't remember. Might have been Afghanistan. So she's with her handler, a Marine, and they go out and they're doing their thing and they get into a firefight and her handler is killed and she's wounded. Maggie is the name of the dog. And then it cuts to Los Angeles where you've got a guy and his partner. They're both police officers and they get into a fight with some bad guys and his partner gets killed and he gets shot. And then, from there it moves, to the future a little bit where both dog and human are recovering. And then they end up together because the police officer is transferred to a canine unit and he starts training with dogs, which is helping him cope with his trauma. And the dog itself, the one that he chooses and won't let go, is the one with the trauma. And from then on, they become inseparable and they grow together and they heal together and then they start to work together. And it was really cool. I think that the author nailed the dog perfectly. And a lot of it is from a dog's point of view. The only other book I can really think of that was from a dog's point of view, but in a different way, was Dean Koontz's Dragon Tears. Have either of you read that one? There was a lot of that book where you remember a dog trotting around, and I listened to this on audiobook, and it was Jay Sanders who read it, and he was like, good dog, good dog. Oh, the dog just wanted to be called good, you know? So the dog would do everything that it could figure out to be good. And he's fighting some real bad guys. But this one, I can give you an example, just a short paragraph of an example of something that was really from the dog's point of view. So you can get a flavor of it. It's right from the prologue. So it's in Afghanistan. So the Marine says, "Want to see it, girl? Want to see what I got?" Pete took a fluorescent green ball from beneath his flak jacket. Maggie's eyes locked on the ball, and she stood like a shot, up on all fours, whining for Pete to throw it. Maggie lived to chase the green ball. It was their favorite toy and her favorite game. Pete would throw it hard and far, and Maggie would power after it, chasing it down with a feeling of purpose and bliss. Catch it, clamp it tight in her jaws, and proudly bring it back, where Pete was always waiting to shower her with love and approval. Chasing the green ball was her absolute favorite game, but now Pete showed her the ball only as a promise of the bliss to come. Maggie knew the routine and was cool with it. If she found the smells Pete had taught her to find, she would be rewarded with the ball. That was their game, and she must find the right smells. Excuse me. And then it goes on, Pete tucked the ball back under his flak and his voice changed from squeaky to firm. He was alpha, and now he spoke in his alpha voice. And there's a lot of that from Maggie, the German Shepherd. She's tight with whoever she considers to be pack. Whoever the alpha male is, or the alpha dog. In this case, both of them were male. But whoever that person is pack. And once they bond in a pack way, then they lock right onto that person. And I find that to be really accurate. An accurate portrayal of how at least our German Shepherd is. You know?
Did it help that the character's name was Scott?
Yeah, the main character's name was Scott.
Very easy to relate to.
So do you read crime novels otherwise, would you
say? I don't read a lot of crime novels. I think that if, for a long time I read almost all science fiction. But before that, if I wasn't going to read science fiction, I was reading general fiction mostly, like John Irving. I like John Irving, you know, that kind of stuff. And I never really did get into crime novels until I read James Lee Burke. And after reading James Lee Burke, and I talked about a crime novel on this by a guy named Craig Johnson. It really, most of the good crime novels really, they're really about the people that are solving the crimes, not so much the crimes. It depends on what kind of book you're reading, but in James Lee Burke's case, it's really about his main character, Dave Robichaux. And, in the case of Craig Johnson, it's really Longmire, the sheriff. And in this case, it's the guy and his dog, you know, Scott and his dog. And that's really the main thing, is watching them operate and watching them team and do their thing as a team. As far as I know, there's no other books with these two characters. I think the book is new, but I think he'd do well to do this again, probably.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it's funny that you mentioned John Irving, just connecting it back to my pick, Geek Love.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Karen, who was on?
Yeah.
She's also reading Geek Love right now. We're in the same book club. And she said that the first three chapters made her think of John Irving. Now, I haven't read enough John Irving to make the connection, but apparently there are some John Irving novels that talk about the circus.
Well, there's one called, I think it's the Hotel New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of a circus element in that one. Yeah, that's the only one that I can recall. You know, I haven't read everything John Irving's written. Yeah.
Just so, a funny connection. Yeah.
Yeah, that is funny. Yep. I mentioned that A Prayer for Owen Meany was my favorite Irving novel.
I think the only one I've read is The 158-Pound Marriage.
I haven't read that.
Yeah.
I did read a crime novel narrated from the dog's point of view.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's called Dog on It by Spencer Quinn.
Oh, cool.
I think it might even be first person from the dog's point of view.
How interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of cute. I think it is a series now, too. There's several of them.
Nice. I think Kuntz has had other novels, too, where he's got a dog in a prominent role.
Yeah, I think he's really into dogs.
Yeah, definitely a dog guy. So cool. All right, well, that's all I've got on that one. So, Tam, what have you got?
Oh, my God. I could see. all right, so the first thing I'll discuss is a nonfiction graphic novel called Understanding Comics, The Invisible Art by Scott McCloud. And I guess it's basically it's what it sounds like. It's about how comics work and how you can understand them and appreciate them. And he has a whole lot of theory that he's thought up about it. Like, he has this triangle of the comic book universe that has it has pictures in one corner, realistic images in one corner, and then words in one corner. And then he says that all comics are veer somewhere between those three corners, having more or less qualities of each one.
Mm-hmm.
Like the corner of pure shapes is more like cartoonish drawings. So you can veer from that to the more realistic drawings. And he has this theory that the more cartoonish you draw a face, the more you can feel like it's you. But if the face is more realistic, he says it's more like someone else, like you're more
separate from it. So like Charlie Brown?
Exactly.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think he uses some examples from Charlie Brown, too, in the book. Yeah, he also has the six type of panel transitions. They go from like a moment to moment to... one of them is action to action. And then all the way at the end is like just non sequitur.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a whole bunch of theories. And I found that really interesting. He doesn't just talk about comics, but he talks about art. And he goes all the way back to like the Egyptian drawings and the pyramids. And
wow.
he tries to say that that's comic books too. That's comics.
Wow.
Yeah, so he tries to tie it all together. So I found that really interesting. And then because of that, I bought his... book called Zot, which is like a collection of all these black and white comics that he did. And it goes up to like 575 pages.
Wow.
And I just got that in the mail, so I'm going to start on that.
Oh, very cool.
So have you read any comics or graphic novels since reading this book?
I think it's mostly actually he has two other nonfiction books. Reinventing Comics and Making Comics. And I started reading Making Comics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I started reading Zot, too, is like fictional comics.
So do you look at it differently after reading?
Yeah, I try to see like all the little methods that he talks about. like he talks about how to show speed. Like you can show the speed from a person standing on the sidewalk, or you can show the speed from a person actually inside the car. And then there's like lines all around the car. He says that the Akira artist does things that way. Like he talks about how Japanese comics are different from American comics and how they were in isolation and they developed their own techniques. And then later on, those techniques came to America. But I guess you two guys don't read.
No, I read some. No, and that would be a really interesting thing for me to look at because there's a lot of things that I don't understand in graphic novels. And the most interesting thing to me is that there seems to be more of a space between the panels.
Oh, he talks about that.
Does he? You know, it just seems like, you know, you do something in a panel and then in the next panel, it's like your brain fills in between the panels. And yeah, he calls that
closure.
Okay. You know, and that's interesting. That's just something that I've noticed in the few that I've read that's different from reading a novel is that it's almost like these finite points that you're hitting, not this continuous stream, you know?
Yeah, he talks about how movies are like a linear progression, but comics are discrete images. And then the reader has to fill in what happens in between each one.
Yeah.
Yeah, he talks about all of that.
Well, that's cool.
Well, and I'd like to have names for what I'm looking at, you know, because I don't know what things are called, like the different styles of the art that happens. I know that sometimes I'll pick up a graphic novel or a comic and I just can't get into it because, you know, sometimes it's because I don't like the art. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes there's too much on a page or, you know.
Oh, yeah, he even talks about like the quality of line, like how there's a wild kind of a line or there's a more clean kind of a line and what kind of tone you can create with each kind of a line.
Yeah. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, another thing in comics that I've noticed a lot that I don't think I quite get is that there's a lot of words that are in bold type sometimes, and I try to read it like that word is emphasized, and sometimes it doesn't make any sense to me.
You know what? That actually confuses me too, and he didn't really go into that. Like, I guess, how do you choose which words are bold? That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know, because it doesn't seem to be because they're emphasizing it, at least it doesn't feel right to me. But maybe there's something else going on there.
Maybe it's just like a subtle emphasis when you're talking.
Yeah,
not
sure.
Not really that strong.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of dogs, there's this comic called WE3 with these three animals, and then they get like these mechanical upgrades to fight for the army.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
And it's really good, and it's kind of interesting because a lot of the panels have no words at all. So it's kind of more like a Japanese manga.
Mm.
So you can read it in like almost 15 or 20 minutes. But there's some really emotional scenes with it.
Wow. That's cool.
I think it's like a dog, a rabbit, and some other animal. Yeah. And they look kind of cute, and yet they have all this war stuff on them. That they met with.
That's cool. So, that's cool.
Yeah. And sounds the art like is really good in that.
WE3. All right.
Yeah. Like Grant Morrison is the writer.
Okay. I've heard that name before, Grant Morrison.
Oh yeah, he's a big in the comic book world. Okay. I think he wrote a nonfiction book about comics too. I think it's called Superhero something.
Mm-hmm.
I think we might have had someone on SF40 that discussed reading it.
Oh, cool. Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Cool.
Yeah, I think even if you're just interested in art, it'd be good to read.
Yeah, sounds good.
Very, very good. Mm-hmm. All right. Jenny, what's up?
Well, the last time we
she
spoke,
laughs.
I know, I'm laughing because every time I say I'm not going to read anything more like X, I always end up reading more. Because the last time I talked about Americana by Adichie, and I said, you know, I felt like I'd already read enough Nigerian authors, and here I am with another Nigerian author. this is Every Day is for the Thief by Teju Cole. And Teju was actually born in the United States and then grew up in Nigeria and now lives in the United States again. That's the author and that's his background. This book was actually originally published in Nigeria in 2007, but only came out in the United States this year. And it's a novel, but it's very much like a memoir. and it's interspersed with pictures that he took when he was in Nigeria. So it seems very realistic, but it's not quite him. I'm pretty sure that's based on a lot of his experience, but it's just about what it's like to be in the United States for 15 years and then return back, quote unquote, home. And his version of Nigeria is a little bit different than Adichie's. It's more, it was more separated. The home that this character goes back to is very large and protected, and they have expensive cars they can travel in. So there's kind of a separation between them and the rest of the culture. So he's much more of an observer than a participant. The funny thing is that the other book I've read by this author is called Open City. And that's all about a Nigerian man who's a doctor wandering the streets of New York City at night and being an observer. So I think it might just be how Teju Cole writes best, kind of a little bit removed, but watching everything and taking in all the details. And I think just right now I'm planning to head back to my home where I grew up that I haven't been to in 9 years. So I think I'm just really resonating a lot with these kinds of stories, even though these people are traveling back to different countries. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cultural difference between home and not home. So
that's interesting. Did it feel like the same theme as the last one? Americana, right?
Yeah.
You said Americana was about fitting in. She was a Nigerian black person, right? Trying to fit in with Americans, and it was a different experience.
Right. And this one didn't speak at all to what the experience in the States was. Mm-hmm. It's just purely what it's like. And it's funny because clearly the color of the character's skin would be the same. And he had grown up in Nigeria, educated in Nigeria. But there's something about him and everyone recognizes immediately that he is not one of them.
So it's a cultural difference.
Yeah. And he doesn't know what it is because he feels like, you know, he's going on these old stomping grounds. He recognizes all these things. He remembers being there. But he's a complete outsider at that point. So, so this book is a lot thinner than Americana was. And it just kind of, it focuses more on how Nigeria has changed. Like in the last 15 years, technology has just boomed. And it talks a lot about how you have to bribe everyone to get anything and how people like the police will stop you and require you to pay a fee right under a billboard that says, help keep our country non-bribe run. And, you know, so there's this kind of discrepancy between what the government is saying and the actual practice of all the people. And with all the press lately about Nigeria, I think that's a pretty realistic observation that people don't seem to have a lot of control of what's going on, mm-hmm. at least not right now. So
good thing America is nothing like that.
I know. Well, we don't have mass kidnappings of our female students.
Yes. But
we do have our own level of corruption, I would imagine. But one of the reasons I picked this book out of all the books I want to read is there's this great author series in Columbia, South Carolina, which is 2 hours from me. And he is on the list to come speak in the fall. So I wanted to make sure I had read everything of his. So I might report back after I go see him speak.
Cool.
But you can follow him on Twitter. He posts a lot.
So can I ask where you're from?
Oregon.
Okay.
Yeah, not a foreign country.
But that's a lot different from where you are now.
Yeah. And anytime you're going back home and it's your family, that's always a big difference, I think. Especially when you're an adult and you haven't lived with them. Okay. So that whole, can you go back home? Will it ever be the same if you're not the same? It's a pretty common theme.
You can never go home again?
Yeah. Can you?
It doesn't exist. It's not the same.
Same river twice?
Yeah.
So I guess that's about all I have.
I don't think I ever left home.
So Scott.
Yeah. Next up for me is The Lady Astronaut of Mars by Mary Robinette Cole. It's a novelette that has been nominated for a Hugo this year. It's a cool story. It was an audio only story last year, which kind of kicked it out of Hugo consideration because it was audio only, and I don't think that the Hugo committee knows what to do with that yet. You know, they don't know whether to call it a dramatic presentation or, you know, a short story. So she, in that tangled web, she ended up kind of getting kicked out of contention. So they published it on tor.com, so it was eligible. So now it's a nominee this year. So it was originally in an audio-only anthology called Rip Off, where the authors were asked to take the first line from a famous classic story and then write their own story after that first line. So in this case, I don't know if either of you have read this, but see if you can guess which story she took it from. The first line is, Dorothy lived in the midst of the great Kansas prairies with Uncle Henry, who was a farmer, and Aunt Em, who was the farmer's wife.
Moby Dick. Just kidding.
You're right. Moby Dick it is. So,
Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Yep, obvious.
Right, right. So from there, she wrote a story about this lady astronaut of Mars who, in this kind of a changed history, I suppose, there was a mission to Mars much, much earlier than there was. And Dorothy, who was mentioned there in that first line, met this lady astronaut of Mars who later went to Mars and then Dorothy grows up to be a doctor and is this lady astronaut of Mars's doctor on Mars. So the story becomes, it's a really interesting story about, the lady astronaut of Mars is an elderly woman who's married and she's asked to go on another mission, which has a really interesting science fiction idea that, there's a thing called a tesseract, which they have these things called longevity missions. They can get between stars by bending space, but
like A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah, I suppose.
That's what they do in A Wrinkle in Time.
Okay, cool. So, but the only way that it can work is somebody has to go there first and set up a tesseract on the other end.
Isn't that a word from Dune?
Tesseract? I don't remember tesseract from Dune.
Okay,
it could be though. I don't remember it from Dune. But anyway.
It makes me think of the movie for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. So she's asked to go do this, you know. And she needs to decide whether or not to do it. And her husband is elderly and is not going to last much longer. So she's trying to decide whether to spend her time with him or to go on this mission. And Dorothy's in there. Anyway, I thought it was a really good story.
Cool.
But yeah, I wanted to talk about Mary really quick, Mary Robinette Cole, because she's kind of changed my mind about the Hugo Awards. She wrote a post when she was nominated for this Lady Astronaut of Mars. You know, there's a lot of brouhaha going on about the Hugos right now. And last year, I didn't really like a lot of the nominees. And I had pretty much said, I'm not going to vote for those anymore. But Mary wrote a post just called The Lady Astronaut of Mars was nominated for a Hugo. And she expressed in that her love for the Hugo Awards. And that reminded me how much I personally love the Hugo Awards and how when I was growing up, I would always get Locus magazine. And that was my link to the whole genre at that point. I subscribed to Locus when I was young, you know, in high school. But anyway, I'd see who the nominees were. I was always excited. And then, you know, I had no idea back then I could even vote or anything like that. And it was always excited to see who the winner would be. And then, but it shaped a lot of my reading. You know, like Mary said in her post, you know, it shaped a lot of her reading when she was younger. And it did for me too, you know. That's how I would find out, you know, whatever was nominated, I would say, oh, you know, look, that's interesting. This is interesting. That's interesting. You know, so it really did shape a lot of my reading in my younger years. And so with all this stuff that's going on right now, my first reaction was that I don't want any part of it. And now with that realization, my thought is I should participate.
It's up to you to save it, Scott.
Yeah, not up to me to save it. But I think that the answer is more people nominating and more people voting rather than less. So,
yeah.
that's what I'm going to do. So I went ahead and I signed up again this year, and I'm going to vote. And I've started to read through all of them.
Okay. Yeah, I think you said only 36 people can nominate.
Well,
something.
Yeah, I looked that up. Last year, one of the, I think it was in the novelette category, the last one in only had 36 nominations. And I think 36 is a number. I didn't look it up before the podcast, but it was in the 30s. So,
I mean, makes sense. It seems like it's easy to organize a small group of people that can get together and get something on the nominations.
Yeah, if they wanted to do that, sure. You know, and I know that that's happened. And, you know, it happened this year, and it's happened in previous years, too. And you can call it for good reasons. You know, some, you know, people have always said that, you know, Foundation's Edge by Isaac Asimov won a Hugo Award. And they're like, well, is that Asimov's best novel? Well, no, it isn't, you know. So you wonder, okay, did people get together and vote for that because they felt like he deserved a Hugo? And maybe they did. You know, so it's not new. There's always going to be a populist piece of the Hugos. It's a popular award. It's voted on by just, you know, fans. So there's going to be an element of who they like. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, the nominating, I think there needs to be more nominators. And I think that that's the key to the award, is doing more nominators. So, and that's something that I may have nominated once or twice is all. And that's something that I'm going to try to do more of.
Well, it's hard to wait to figure out everything that's eligible wade through it.
Yeah,
so,
I don't think that a person needs to do that, though. I think what a person would do is read the things that the person likes to read. And if the person comes across things that they feel are Hugo eligible, then that person should nominate him.
Hmm.
But I don't think that I would have a responsibility, for example, to go find a small market magazine and read that just so I can find things to vote for. I would keep my eyes open and see if there are people talking about whatever, or see if someone recommends something to me, I might read it. But I would read my normal things, but then make the effort to nominate as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I were to try to read everything, you know, that I could possibly find, then I'm done reading. That would be all I could ever possibly do, you know. But I think the thing is just that if you come across something that you feel is Hugo worthy, that you go ahead and you note that during the year, and then you nominate in January. And that's something that I haven't done a lot of. So, but I'm going to start.
Good. Mm-hmm. Now, this story was on that Ripoff anthology originally.
Right.
I'm kind of surprised it wasn't also on the Oz Reimagined anthology that just came out, I think, this last year. It was put together by John Joseph Adams.
Well, I guess, yeah, it really had nothing to do with Oz other than that first line. I guess it could possibly. Yeah, it really wasn't an Oz retelling in any way.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
just. So they could take it any direction.
Absolutely.
After that.
It was just use the first line and write a story.
Have you listened to any of the others from that by
no,
any chance?
No, and I read this one. I didn't listen to it. I never did listen to that anthology. It's a cool idea, though.
It is. It sounds like an interesting idea.
Yeah. Have you listened to it, Tam?
No, but I want to.
Yeah.
I wish she would write a science fiction novel.
Yeah, I think that this is novel worthy, this world that she created here.
It would be
interesting to, if it was novel length, I think I would read it. In fact, I know I would read it.
Have either of you read her novels?
I haven't. She writes Regency fantasy, I guess you would call it.
Right.
I've read several of her short stories, but I have never read any of her Regency novels. And I like Pride and Prejudice, so
okay.
I directed a play once. So I know it pretty well, but in fact, I think the novel is really good. But no, I never have read any of her Regency stuff.
I read the first one.
What did you think?
Well, and I think I read it because it was nominated for a Nebula, and that was one of the years I read everything in the Nebulas. I mean, the Jane Austen comparison is the best one. I mean, that's how it feels. And the magical element in there is actually pretty light.
Hmm.
And that's really the only fantasy element in there. So it's a well-written novel. I haven't gone back to the series or trilogy, whichever it is, to read the other Glamour and Glass. Isn't that the name of the... Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't gone back to those, but I know some people really love them.
Yeah. Well, good.
Yeah. I just remember the scene in a dining room mm-hmm. where it's like, you know, one of those formal type scenes that's so important in that period. But then there's magic involved too, and the walls and the lights, and, you know, that stuck in my head over 3 years.
Huh.
So that's something, isn't it?
Very cool.
I guess the magic is like just 1% of the book, kind of like Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of woven in there, but it's not as much of a departure as, say, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies was.
Okay.
Yep.
And, of course, it's an original story. So.
Well, that's that. Tim, what have you got?
Uh-oh. Okay, so... there's a short story called Passengers by Robert Silverberg.
Oh, yeah.
And this Jesse would mention it once in a while on SFF Audio, and I would always be intrigued. It's about mm-hmm. A world where aliens just possess your body at any random time, and there's nothing you can do about it. And then they, like, use you for a while, like, for a night, and then you wake up in the morning, and they're gone, and you're disheveled, your room's a mess and everything. I was like, oh, I really want to read this. Then one day I just Googled, and it's on EscapePod. The audio and the full text are there for free.
Oh, cool.
So I loaded it up in my car, and it's like 40 minutes long, and I played it, and I thought it was really, really good.
Cool. I like that story a lot, too.
Oh, you've heard it?
I've read it, yeah. Yeah, it's tough.
Oh, yeah, the ending is kind of brutal. Yeah.
And you don't remember. You wake up with cigarette butts and in someone's bed, maybe.
And, then he meets this woman, and it's really emotional. Like, he tries to connect with this woman, and he's mm-hmm. struggling. I thought that part was really good.
Yeah, because they don't have memories, right? And it was like he had this thread of a memory of being with her. And there's a social convention that has grown up around this, that you don't ever do that. It's like, you know, if you see someone, you know, making the walk of shame home, everyone looks away, because it's just become social convention.
Right.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's rough. Good story.
Yeah. It's a really good story.
Silverberg's excellent. He really is.
The only thing I've ever read by him, but I've heard about him for years.
Wow. Yeah, he's written a lot of good stuff. I mean, yeah.
Well, what's a good Silverberg novel? Have you read any?
Yeah. How about Book of Skulls? Book of Skulls might be an abnormal one, though, or a typical one, not abnormal. It's about a group of four guys at a university in New York, and one of them in the stacks of the library finds instructions for immortality. And the instructions include going to a monastery in Arizona. And it also says that you need four people and two of them will fall away. So one of them needs to sacrifice and one of them needs to die. So these four guys, all with eyes wide open and knowing that, take the trip to Arizona. And... then I'll let you guys figure out what happens from there. It's not a very long novel, but it's really good.
Sounds like similar to Passengers, like a kind of a rough story.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of a rough story. And it's very much a character-driven thing because it's written like George R. R. Martin did Game of Thrones, where each chapter is, the title of the chapter is the character's name. And each character is, you know, very different. And, you know, you hear their thoughts, what they think about this, and, you know, somebody might be thinking, you know, well, I'm going to be the one that survives. There's no way I'm not going to. And one of them is going thinking that he'll commit suicide. And, you know, then you just ride with them to find out how it ends.
Yeah. And Passengers, it sounds like he would be a good, like, mainstream writer, like without even any fantastic element.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. And he's super prolific, too. He's written a ton of stuff.
Yeah, I know. He has this book, Lord Valentine's Castle, which is kind of about juggling. And I think Luke Burge has reviewed it.
Oh, cool.
But yeah. I haven't read it.
Yeah, I haven't read it either.
I think he found problems with the juggling details since he's an expert.
Yeah, that's funny.
But otherwise, it was good.
Him and Ted Chiang really returned me to science fiction, short fiction, in a big way. I remember I had a handspring. Do you guys remember these devices? A handspring. It was like a Palm Pilot, but it was by a company named Handspring.
I know what Palm Pilot is.
Yeah, and I think it was from... I'm trying to remember the name of the store, Paperback Digital or something like that. One of the first ebook stores that ever was. Peanut Press, maybe, something like that. Fiction-wise, could be. Anyway, I bought the year's best science fiction. And in that thing, the first story I read was Stories of Your Life by Ted Chiang, which blew me away. And then the second one I read was These Alien Years by Robert Silverberg, and that blew me away. It was part of what was later a novel that Silverberg wrote, but they both just completely blew me away, and I was like, holy cow, short fiction is great.
Maybe it was the device.
Yeah, it was the device, right? I need to get that handspring back.
Yeah. That was the magic.
Old black and white little handheld Palm Pilot.
Huh, I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Well, have you heard of a Palm Pilot?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just like that, but it was just a company called Handspring.
Hmm.
Doesn't exist anymore, I'm fairly sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Never heard of it. Ted Chiang is nominated for Hugo this year.
He is, and I haven't read his story yet, but I've got it.
Okay.
Still haven't seen the packet, but I've got the story.
You can get the whole Wheel of Time series in the packet.
Don't get me started on Wheel of Time, but yes, I'm going to have the entire set on ebook. It's very exciting. I do not dislike Wheel of Time, by the way. I don't. Sorry.
What is the name of the organization that you have to join
The World Science Fiction Society.
Okay. And they're that doesn't change.
Right. They're the ones who run the Worldcon.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's what the bylaws are, is the World Science Fiction Society Constitution. Yep.
Gotcha.
And you'll get Saga, too. That's a really good comic book series.
Cool.
That's nominated for Hugo.
Fantastic. Yep.
That is, like, really good dialogue. It's the same writer that, well, maybe this is a bad example, but he's doing the Under the Dome TV show.
Oh,
he's running it.
Is he?
Brian K. Vaughan, yeah.
He's running it. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, so is he's really good at dialogue.
Apparently it is still on.
I guess I stopped watching it.
Yeah, I kind of stopped watching it, but I love Saga so much. I almost feel like going back to Under the Dome just because it's the same guy.
Yeah, just to see what he's doing.
Yeah,
that's cool. I guess he can pull off things in Saga that seem more unbelievable when a real actor is saying the words. Maybe that's the problem.
Hmm.
Well, cool. Well, thank you very much. Love that story. Love it. All right, Jenny.
Okay. Well, this book has an interesting story to it. I was wandering the shelves in my library and looking for poetry books that I wanted to read in April. And I came across this book that was clearly not poetry. It's just a little too thick, called Crazy Love. And I was like, that sounds interesting. I pulled it out. And it says, Nebula winning author, Leslie Watt. And I was like, who? Yeah. Well, it might be what. It's W-H-A-T. Never heard of her in my life.
I think I read her story that won the award.
Yeah,
is it called
probably.
The Cost of Doing Business or something like that? Okay.
Yeah, and that's the only thing that she seems to be known for that I can find. This book of stories did win an award in Oregon. She's an Oregon author. But other than that, I don't think she's published anything since, at least not in book form, maybe in story form. But I was like, well, I've never heard of you, and you won an award that I pay attention to, so maybe, you know, I'll just bring you home. And actually read it tonight. I couldn't decide what else I wanted to talk about, so I was like, well, maybe if I read this whole book. And it's really kind of interesting. I mean, the Nebula Award kind of assumes that there is fantasy or science fiction present. But a lot of the stories, it's very subtle. It's just like a little tiny twist of maybe something unreal. I mean, there are a few that have ghosts and werewolves and strange science, but it's always a very subtle detail, which I kind of liked. I kind of like the little tiny twinges of it in there rather than it kind of hitting you over the head with it, you know? So for instance, there's one called My Hermit, where this woman is studying the science that makes people hermits. It's like a chromosome. And so she's looking for someone that she can have a child with that will make them not hermits, because her father was a hermit and that affected their relationship. Then there's the story called Paper Mates, about the office paper and machines that are reproducing when the guy goes on vacation. So that one's kind of silly. The Cost of Doing Business is probably best known, and it's about I forgot the word for it. It's you pay someone to suffer for you, basically. And so it's a kind of a interesting story, but there's kind of a, I don't want to call it a twist, because you know something about the main character that changes her motivation for being this person. So people pay her to get beat up by other people. She spends a lot of time having surgery, fixing herself from these people hurting her. So, yeah.
Sounds like Fight Club.
Yeah, kind of, only escalated quite a bit, where this is like a societal thing and there are people out there that get paid for this. Kind of like prostitutes, only for violence, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because, like, the guy who pays her, he stops the criminals and he asks them if they will take this arrangement instead. You know, they like have their baseball bats out. And he's like, okay, here, sign this contract agreeing that you'll beat this person up instead of me. And they do it. They stop and they sign. And
jeez.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Possibly my favorite story was called That Jellyfish Man Keeps a Rollin'. And it's
that
so
sounds
strange.
Like the best story in there.
Yeah, well, you know how things just kind of start making connections when you're reading different stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I had just finished Geek Love, which had the Flipper Boy, and this character was practically the same. It's in a society where everyone changes their physique, but most people are adding metal rods to their bones so that they live forever and they can be ballerinas forever. And then they end up having to work forever because their bodies never deteriorate. Well, this guy decided to go the opposite direction. And so he slithers and slurps around and he can cut himself on broken glass, which gives him a high. But of course, people that would be like jellyfish, you heal really easily because you're made of that spongy material. So the story is mostly of him traveling to have Thanksgiving with his daughter, who of course is horrified that he is her father. So that was a kind of interesting story. And there's a lot of variety here. I would say that in general the stories have far too many babies and pregnancies for my taste. Like almost every story, that was like one of the major things in it. So I think maybe that was just where the author was at that point in her life, but it makes them feel more, I don't like to divide things by gender, but these definitely feel more like stories for women, only women with really different tastes that are more along the fantasy lines, I guess. So it was really kind of a fun ride to do. It's so strange to pick up a book that I've never heard of the author. That doesn't happen to me very often. I don't often bring something home from the library that I hadn't heard of before. So
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I was glad I did.
I enjoy that too.
You got lucky. That's good.
Yeah. And nice. I looked up who else was nominated in 1999 and I didn't recognize the other authors either.
Oh,
so
really? Yeah.
Might have been a different year.
Interesting. Well, yeah. Yeah, the Nebulas are different from the Hugos in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't it author vote?
Yeah.
Authors vote only?
Exactly. The Science Fiction Writers Association picks those. Yep.
That's coming up soon, too.
Is it really?
I think so.
Yeah, because it's always before the Hugos.
Oh. Oh, I didn't even notice the nominees are out and everything.
Yeah.
I've kind of been out of it.
Yeah, Sword of Laser is going to interview some of the authors, like Gregory Benford and Samuel Delaney.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys are nominated for awards this year?
I guess
so. Or just maybe Grandmasters or something.
Yeah, I think Delaney's getting the Grandmaster.
Yeah, Delaney, yeah.
Cool.
I didn't know he was still alive.
Still alive. That's cool. That's fun. Well, great. All right. Thank you very much.
Can I call it Chick-lit?
Chick-lit.
Is that PC?
Would you call it chick lit, Jenny?
Well, I think it's a hard sell with mm-hmm. all the pregnancies and babies running around to get anyone else to read it.
Gotcha. Cool. All right. Well, my last one this time, I'm not sure if you two noticed the big fancy to-do they had at the Vatican a couple weeks ago, where they sainted Pope John Paul and Pope John the 23rd. Mm-hmm. So that got me interested. I looked for a book on Pope John the 23rd. And I found that they had one of the Penguin Lives volumes on him written by Thomas Cahill. So I'm not quite finished with it. It's a very good book so far, and I'm surprised. I don't know if you know the Penguin Lives series, but they're all around 200 pages, and Thomas Cahill spends a lot of time talking about the history of the papacy at the beginning, at least the first third of the book, which is surprising for so short a biography. But anyway, I'm enjoying it very much, and the Penguin Lives series itself is something that I really, really enjoy. They're biographies, like I said, that are about 200 pages long, and which is usually perfect for me. You know, one of the things, you know, I see a book like on George Washington, you know, Washington, A Life by Chernow, that's got to be 700, 800, 900 pages long. And I'm interested in reading that, but it's like I never seem to get to it, you know. But if I had a 200-page book on George Washington, my chances of getting to it are very, very good. And mm-hmm. often I would read something like that and get interested in a person's life and then go ahead and read something longer. But the cool thing about the Penguin Live series is that the books are written by authors that are known for other things than biographies. Like, I got a list in front of me. Jane Austen by Carol Shields. Napoleon by Paul Johnson, who is a historian. Jane Smiley wrote Charles Dickens. St. Augustine, and I've read some of these. Like, St. Augustine I've read. Jane Austen I read. Martin Luther by Martin E. Marty, who's another historian, I believe. Mozart they've got. Crazy Horse by Larry McMurtry, who won a Pulitzer for Lonesome Dove. Abraham Lincoln by Thomas Kennelly. Now, Thomas Cahill, who wrote Pope John the 23rd, wrote How the Irish Saved Civilization. You guys recognize that title?
Yes, yeah. I thought his name sounded familiar. I've read that book.
Right, me too.
It's good.
Buddha by Karen Armstrong, who's a religion writer. Joan of Arc I read by Mary Gordon. That was interesting. See, there's Joseph Smith. I haven't read that, but I want to. By a guy named Robert Remini, who's an American historian. Dante by R.W.B. Lewis. I don't know who that is, but Leonardo da Vinci I read by Sherwin B. Newland. And again, you know, these, like I said, the length of it is just perfect. It's a book, you know, something you can pick up and read in a few days and then, you know, really come away feeling like you've learned something. And maybe are interested enough to pursue further. So I wish they'd do more of them, but I don't think they're making them anymore. There's 33 of them right now. And it's interesting. I have no idea how they selected who to do or not, you know. Somebody did George Herbert Walker Bush by Tom Wicker, and there's very few presidents in there. I'm not sure if they approached these authors and said, you know, is there somebody's life you'd be interested in? And go ahead and write it. John Keegan, who's a military historian, wrote Winston Churchill. So if you're interested in Winston Churchill, you know, 200 pages, you get a really good flavor.
So did you learn anything you didn't know about Pope John the, did you say 23rd?
John the 23rd, yeah. He's the Pope who convened Vatican II. That's what he's known for. So before Vatican II, which was a collection of all the bishops, and they made reforms in the church, the most visible one of which is they started doing mass in native languages rather than Latin all the time. Kind of a modernization of the church, or a a response or a making of the church that could be received easier in a modern world. So the main things that I've learned up to this point is that I knew nothing about him prior to his papacy, you know, where he came from, and he, that he was a scholar, that he was never a parish priest. That was all interesting stuff to me. And again, I said, you know, I'm not quite finished with it, but probably about 50 pages from being finished.
Hmm.
And then all of the papal history, you know, that's things that you, you know, you glean, you know, being Catholic, you know, you read that stuff all the time and you look at the stuff, positive and negative. And, you know, the sheer personality of the popes is a really interesting phenomenon. You know, when one is selected and it's really their personality and their tone that seems to put an imprint on the time in the church. You know, like Pope John Paul II was, I mean, he was in there for a really long time, but he had a specific tone about him. And then Pope Benedict did, and now Pope Francis does. And it's just an interesting, that the whole papacy, you know, just one time I talked about the presidency on this podcast. It's just an interesting office. You know, the Pope is an interesting office. It's very interesting, the people who have held that position and the history of it just interests me a lot. So now he's St. Pope John Paul II, 23rd.
Now they have to put out a new version of the book.
You bet. So, but yeah, I enjoy those. I enjoy biographies quite a bit, really. I would like to read even more of them. Like I have Einstein, Walter Isaacson, that I need to get to. Really interests me a lot.
I was going to say, now you can tackle Hyland's biography. That's really long.
Hyland's biography. Who wrote that?
I forget his name.
Yeah. I'm sure there's even more than one biography, but.
Well, yeah. I think that biography is in like two books. It's so long.
Oh, is it really? Wow.
Yeah. But unfortunately, he just passed away, so I guess that's the end of that.
Yeah. The guy who wrote the biography, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
But yeah, I think the second book is coming out pretty soon. It's all finished.
William H. Patterson?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I just looked it up here online. Yeah, you know, the lives of science fiction authors, that's an interesting thing. You know, some of them live very mundane lives, but some of them are really interesting. I'm sure Hyland
had an interesting life.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. I've got a book of John W. Campbell's letters, and I love opening that up and just reading a few. It's really fun. I'm surprised that they haven't published more of volumes of his letters.
He had an interesting life?
I don't know how interesting his whole life was, but his letters were interesting.
Okay.
Well, that's all I've got there on my Penguin Lives.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, Tam, what do you have for your last one?
Okay, I just finished this yesterday. It's Hammered by Elizabeth Baer.
Ooh.
It's her first novel. It was science fiction. It has it has virtual reality. It has the main character is Jenny Casey, and she's 49 years old, and she's kind of breaking down. She has a metal arm, so she has I guess she's a cyborg, and the parts are kind of wearing down. And then there's a manipulative guy from the military that wants to get her back in the military. But it has a lot of older women characters. It's kind of different than the usual adventure book with a man. It's funny though. It has she's Canadian, and there's bits where they start going into French when they're excited, but you have no idea what they're saying. It's a little weird.
Would you call this a military science fiction book?
Actually. So this is a series of three books. So in the first book, she's just kind of ramping up.
Mm-hmm.
So she doesn't really do any fighting in the first book, but she has this friend Razorface, who has all metal blades for teeth.
Wow!
And he does some shootouts. And then there's this guy Mitch, who's a cop. So some of the secondary characters, it's more like street fights with guns and stuff.
Hmm.
So it's not really military, although the military are like in the shadows, manipulating things. But it's kind of a combination of like all kinds of science fiction. There's actually spaceships later on, and there's like hints of maybe an alien later on. But these things are all being set up for like the second book. But it's definitely offbeat.
Yeah, so she's written a lot since then. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at her.
She likes to change up what she does. So she does all kinds of different books.
So she's not really a military SF writer, you would say?
No, she actually said she would have had a much better career if she just stuck with the Jenny Casey books for the rest of her life. But she chose not to.
Oh, yeah. Shoggoths and Bloom. I've read that. That's kind of a Cthulhu story. Yep. Very nice. Yeah, I'm just looking at that. There's her short story collection is named after that story.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, should I read the second Jenny Casey book, or should I just go to her fantasy series, starting with Range of Ghosts, which is kind of like fantasy, but it's like inspired by India instead of inspired by Europe.
Oh. Inspired by India?
Yeah, like more Asian-type history.
Yeah.
And I think like the horse Mongolians. Like the horse tribes.
Okay.
She says it's not like a literal history, but she drew inspiration from that instead of making it a typical like European environment for fantasy.
That's cool. Yep. Timur, grandson of the great Khan, is walking away from a battlefield where he was left for dead. All around lie the fallen armies of his cousin and his brother, who made war to rule the Khaganate. The Khaganate. How cool.
She seems really smart. Like the book I read is just slightly more challenging than say like a John Scalzi book where it's made really easy for you.
Yeah.
But I was going to read from 20% in the book. Okay. If you live long enough, you will eventually put on a real fine point on what you're willing to do to stay alive and what you're willing to sell. The first thing I sold was my body, first on the street, then to the army once I got old enough. Later on, I graduated to selling the intangibles. I like to think I stayed loyal to my friends, though. That was something. So the main character is pretty eloquent. You can almost say that she's talking like a writer, but that happens so often when I read.
Very cool.
Well, you know, I have a copy of it sitting on my desk.
Oh.
Because of you.
Oh.
It sounded really interesting, so I got a copy, but I haven't started.
It's kind of cyberpunk, which you like.
Mm-hmm. Or post-human type stuff where people start modifying themselves. I usually like that.
Yeah, and there's nanotechnology too. There's all kinds of things.
Cool. Artificial
intelligence. Well, she sounds like my kind of person. Her description on Amazon is, I tell stories. I prefer the mountains to the desert and rain to sun. My eyes are blue. I like flying on airplanes, but they keep making the seats smaller. And that's the whole description.
That's funny.
I, too, prefer mountains to the desert and probably rain to sun.
Yeah, she was on Sword and Laser, and I got my question through.
Oh, cool.
Because she's on the podcast, the SF Squeakcast, and they ask silly questions at the end, and hers is, what would you like on your tombstone? So I kind of turned around on her, and she didn't really want to answer for herself, but she said, well, my character Jenny Casey would say, you should see the other guy.
Nice, nice.
And I got my name mentioned.
Very cool. Another mention, another Tamahome sighting.
Yes, another notch for the belt.
Yep. Nice, very nice, very nice. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. That's awesome.
Sure.
All right, Jenny, have you got anything else?
Mm-mm.
All right. Well, thanks, you two. I enjoyed myself as always.
Me too. I feel bad because I actually gave Geek Love 5 stars and I'm not sure it came across that way. Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.